But the intent we were always going to attack, since we determined that the negotiations, which had happened 2 days earlier, weren't going anywhere.
Crystal clear.
So there you go. I mean, these guys are...
It's on camera. It is literally on camera, him saying
Were you
this.
There, Emma? Were you actually there when the question was asked in the same...
The best part is the person... I asked the question. That's what she said.
Perhaps CNN and Fox News and the Associated Press and the other outlets that were there are on their live feed were using that Tim Pool filter that we use to make his music sound so bad. But, and that's why we misunderstood Marco Rubio explicitly saying that we're going
Mike
to
Johnson
war.
Did we have Johnson from yesterday? Did we play that yesterday?
Because Israel was going to strike. Yeah.
Mike Johnson said the exact same thing.
Yes, he did.
Okay, let's pull up Mike Johnson, because he said the exact same thing right after Rubio said it. So they clearly were told, at least at one point yesterday or the day before. I think we did play this, but let's just play it again.
Yeah.
This is quite a coincidence.
To me, the most critical point is that this was a defensive measure, a defensive operation. And why is
pause it for a second. He just said it was a defensive measure, whereas Rubio said, no, we had intended to do this because we weren't going to let them have all this capacity. And now he's saying it's a defensive measure because.
No, this is not classified. So I'll tell you what I think is important. Israel was determined to act in their own defense here, with or without American support. Why? Because Israel faced what they deemed to be an existential threat. Iran was building missiles at a radical rapid clip, to the point where our allies in the region could not keep up. As you know, Iran has long vowed to take out Israel, wipe it off the map, and they have long seen that as a critical threat to their very existence. Because Israel was determined to act, with or without the U.S., our commander-in-chief and the administration and the officials I just named had a very difficult decision to make. They had to evaluate the threats to the U.S., to our troops, to our installations, to our assets in the region and beyond. And they determined, because of the exquisite intelligence that we had, that if Israel fired upon Iran and took action against Iran to take out the missiles, then they would have immediately retaliated against U.S. personnel and assets.
That doesn't sound remotely like what Rubio said hours after that, having said what Johnson said hours before Johnson said it, and then going back and saying, no, we were always going to attack. It was just a question of timing. That's not at all what Mike Johnson is saying.
No.
I mean, this is... And then you watch the news, and there's some news outlets that are more skeptical than others. But, I mean, honestly, this is like for years and years and years, Republicans were the responsible people when it comes to waging war. And no Democratic president could hire a Secretary of Defense that was anything but a Republican. This is ridiculous.
The crime of this also, I feel like in the Western press, is completely being papered over. Tehran is like the equivalent of New York City for Iran. It is massive. It is sprawling. And we are bombing over and over again this major urban center in a country with tens of millions of people. We killed over 160 little girls with a bomb that was dropped on a school there. Can you imagine what the United States' response would be to that? Can you imagine what the press would be saying if 160 Israeli girls were killed by a bomb from Hamas, from a bomb from... They would nuke the country of Iran tomorrow. And, like, I mean, as we're talking about nuclear weapons and the possibility of Iran building a nuclear weapon, which the U.S.'s own intelligence says they have not been pursuing since, I think, 2003, 2002... In part because the Ayatollah Khomeini, who they just killed, was more conservative, and the more hawkish Iranians were critical of him, saying that he should take a more aggressive posture towards the United States. Now, apparently, his son is going to be taking over in the interim. What do you think his stance is going to be after they just killed his mother and father? I'm not sure if it's the same mother, but at the very least, his father. Like, there's no strategy. Trump even said it himself that they killed some of their other options to take over this country.
Whoopsie.
I mean, we are committing an horrific crime against humanity, and the and we have some Democrats who are on board with it in a way that doesn't just morally scream how horrible this is, but the destabilization effects are going to actually really harm United States interests. And it's because the Zionist lobby has completely, and the weapons manufacturers and all of it, completely taken over, frankly, U.S. policy beyond what actually is going to advance U.S. interests.
All right. And we're going to cover the primaries that took place yesterday. The big news, of course, is that James Tallarico is going to be the Texas Democratic nominee for the Senate. And we don't know who the Republican nominee is going to be. It's going to be a runoff between Paxton and Cornyn. And in some respects, that may be more relevant than who actually won the Democratic primary in Texas, because Paxton is a lot more of a polarizing figure than is Cornyn. I think probably Crockett was probably more of a polarizing figure on the Democratic side. Again, I don't know that if Crockett or Tallarico were to win the Texas Senate seat, that they would be our favorite senators based upon the politics coming out of Texas. But at the end of the day,
be my favorite one out of Texas.
But Tallarico,
out of Texas, exactly.
But just a quick note on it. But Tallarico's theory of politics is actually a lot more productive than Crockett's, and that's what I like coming out of it. I'm a little bit more bullish on this being a significant improvement than if Crockett won that primary. Given he goes to all of the counties and campaigns everywhere. The coalition that he's accrued of Latino voters could actually break the Trump 2024 coalition. So just from a pure electability standpoint, this is a success.
I think the electability question was answered with the Democratic primary. I mean,
definitely.
If you can't win the Democratic primary, you're probably not that electable. It's not like Tallarico was running to the left dramatically to the left of Crockett. I don't think is from an issue standpoint anyways. All right. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Brian Reed and Michael Masnick on the question of Section 230. It's not quite a debate, but they have different opinions on it. And I'm sort of somewhere maybe in the middle. I'm not sure, but we'll talk about that in a moment. First, a couple words from our sponsors. You cannot out-exercise a bad diet. A balanced diet is a crucial component of supporting healthy lifestyle. Nutrient gaps can still happen, however, due to genetics, due to dietary preferences, and even modern farming practices that deplete soil of its nutrients. You don't really think about that much, but, you know, what a radish or a beet had 30 years ago may be different than it is today. But nevertheless, Ritual's team of scientists have pored over thousands of studies to identify the common gaps between nutrient needs and what people are actually consuming across different life stages. For me, I started taking Ritual, I don't know, several years ago. To be honest, the big thing for me was the convenience, both in terms of the fact that they would ship it to me on a regular basis and that I could take it at any time during the day because it's their formulation is gentle on the stomach, and I no longer have a deficiency in vitamin D. But also, I appreciate the fact that it's traceable, and they know where all of their vitamins come from, which is really important because there's some places where you get stuff, and you know, they don't have the same regulations about what can be in the soil, et cetera, et cetera. Ritual is a science-backed multivitamin for men 18 plus. I take the ones for a little bit older, with key ingredients like omega-3 DHA to support heart health and brain health, and vitamin D3 to support normal muscle and immune function. Ritual's essential for men 18 plus multivitamin contains 10 key nutrients in two delayed release capsules that are designed for optimal absorption per day. They are designed to be gentle on the stomach with a minty essence in every bottle that helps making taking your multis actually enjoyable. Look, the human body turns out to be not unlike a car. You got to get your oil changed or you're going to have real problems down the road. So take your vitamins. I know when you're 25 years old, you don't think about this stuff. But believe me, do yourself a favor. You can't go backwards in time. Instead of striving for perfect health, I'm not complaining, but what are you going to do? You start to fall apart at my age and you realize, like, I should have done this stuff earlier. Instead of striving for perfect health, aim for supporting foundational health. That was exactly my point. Save 25% on your first month at ritual.com/majority. That's ritual.com/majority for 25% off your first month. Also, and we'll put the information in the podcast and YouTube description. One of my big projects has been going more plastic free in my house for years. You've heard about this. And the number one factor in doing that has been Blue Land cleaning products. I used to carry home a huge jug of dishwashing liquid. I used to carry home a huge jug of laundry detergent. I used to carry home all these plastic bottles of, spray window stuff and bathroom cleaner and multi-cleaner. I no longer do that. And for the toilets as well. I have those like little bombs. Blue Land is on a mission to make it easy for everyone to make the sustainable choices. They believe that hardworking, clean products can be the norm, not the exception, and you can do better for your family and the planet at the same time. Blue Land products are independently tested to perform alongside major brands, and their formulas are free from dyes, free from parabens, and free from harsh chemicals. Blue Land is a certified B Corporation and certified cruelty-free by Leaping Bunny. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many have received the Gold Material Health Certificate from Cradle to Cradle. And Blue Land's trusted in over 1 million homes, including mine. I've got the dishwashing tablets. They're fantastic. They're not wrapped in plastic, so none of that stuff ends up in your dishwasher. I've got three color-coded spray bottles with cleaners, and you buy the tablets. First of all, it's also I find it to be much less expensive. I have laundry tablets. I get the laundry extra powder for extra cleaning. I mean, the whole suite of Blue Land products are fantastic. I've got the toilet bombs. You just drop the tablet in there. You don't have that big spray bottle with the plastic. It really is. It saves you a lot of time. I don't know if it saves you time. Well, you don't go to the supermarket, but it saves you a lot of space in your house or your apartment. Blue Land has a special offer for listeners right now. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/majority. You don't want to miss this. blueland.com/majority for 15% off. That's blueland.com/majority. Get 15% off. All right, quick break. When we come back, Brian Reed, investigative journalist, host of Question Everything on KCRW, and Mike Masnick, editor of Tech Dirt, and on the board of the directors for Blue Sky, we're going to talk about Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is a real pleasure to welcome to the program Brian Reed, investigative journalist, host of Question Everything on KCRW, also the co-host of The Trojan Horse, one of my favorite podcasts of a couple of years ago. Mike Masnick, editor of Tech Dirt, and on the board of directors for Blue Sky. I should say I'm on Blue Sky, and I also read Tech Dirt. So this is fun for me. Now, guys, about 30 years ago, almost, I guess, a month, 30 years ago and a month ago, the Telecommunications Act, or I should not say the Telecommunications Act, but the Communications Decency Act was passed containing Section 230, which is really now the most famous part of it, and in many respects is largely the only remaining part after the Supreme Court dealt with this. My understanding, and Mike, why don't we start with you on this? This came out of a court case or a series of court cases, Cubby versus CompuServe, and then subsequent to that, Stratton Oakmont versus Prodigy. And this comes out of, there is a concept in tort law, which hopefully my audience knows what tort law is. I go to the conference every year. That being like when a harm is done, it is a civil proceeding against a corporation. And there's this concept of Good Samaritan. If you start to help somebody in some way, you gain more liability than if you just sort of walked on by and didn't try and interfere. And this case, Prodigy versus Oakmont, Prodigy was moderating. I can't remember what Oakmont was. They were some company. They were getting, I guess, besmirched. Because Prodigy moderated, it actually increased their liability. And Ron Wyden and I can't remember who the Republican
Chris
was.
Cox.
Chris Cox decided to really encourage moderation, right? And tell us, pick it up from there and tell us what the sure. idea behind 230 was.
Yeah, and just so you're familiar with it, if you've seen the movie The Wolf of Wall Street, that was Stratton Oakmont.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. Yeah, yeah,
it was
wow.
a boiler room operation, and somebody went onto Prodigy's forums and basically said these guys are scammers, which, you know, hey, in retrospect, probably.
Yeah.
But they didn't like that, and they were aggressive, and so they sued Prodigy. And the argument that the judge in the case bought was that because Prodigy set itself up as we want to be family friendly, which means we moderate, we will, you know, take down anything that we think is inappropriate. That meant that anything that they left up, then they were liable for in any kind of tort lawsuit, which was what happened with Stratton Oakmont. And so Chris Cox and Ron Wyden said, that is going to lead to very bad results if companies that feel that they want to create a family-friendly environment are suddenly facing massive, you know, potentially ruinous liability. They're not going to do that. They're going to just allow all of the worst stuff and not do any of the moderation that we want. So can we create a tool within the framework of the First Amendment that creates incentives for companies to moderate? And the way that they do that, the structure of Section 230, which you were correct in the beginning, by the way, when you said the Communications Act, because the Communications Decency Act was tucked right. into the Communications Act, was to basically say, if you're an interactive computer service, if you're a website or a app or whatever, or a user of one of those apps, we don't hold you liable as if you were the publisher of someone else's content that you do publishing related activities to, whether that is hosting, promoting, sharing, anything like that. We're not going to hold you liable, which means you can begin to do the kinds of moderation because you have the incentive structure that if you make a mistake, you're not necessarily
going to be punished.
You're right. not going to be sued out of business is really what it is.
And so we should say there are two subsections that are the most important, I think, of Section 230. One is C1, which has the famous 26 words, no provider or user of interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. And the second subsection, C2, says no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be held liable on account of any action voluntary taken in good faith to restrict access, that's the moderation, or availability of material that the provider or user considers to be obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. Okay, all well and good, but Brian, from your perspective, where are we 30 years later with Section 230?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an argument for why Section 230 was passed at the time, and there's an argument for it now still. I think my perspective on it and others, and I would say like an increasing number of Americans who say they're unhappy with the way that the internet is and how it's affecting our society, is that a lot of companies haven't lived up to that Good Samaritan end of the bargain. And the bargain didn't require them to. It's not, you know, the law had no requirement that they be Good Samaritans. It was just a hope that they would be in exchange for this immunity. And I just think the evidence, the changing nature of the internet, the growing power of a lot of internet companies, even though this law does protect companies and non-companies, big and small, it does confer protection onto some of the most powerful companies in our society. And I think the evidence has increasingly shown they haven't lived up to that end of the bargain. And I think it's worth reconsidering it while really keeping in mind the effects it could have on free speech, which is very important on the internet. But I'm increasingly uncomfortable with the trade-offs that are involved in, you know, one of the stated purposes of Section 230, which is to protect free speech on the internet. It's also, I believe, allowed a lot of bad behavior.
And I got to say, like, I broadly speaking, that is sort of my perspective too. So Michael, from your perspective, is 230, like, is it sacrosanct? Should we not be reforming it? I mean, in 1996, I'm old enough to remember dial-up, and I was there, and I remember getting my first computer in the late 80s, I guess. But the there was like 2% of people were online, and it was a huge pain in the ass. And yeah, it wasn't. I mean, do you think that Section 230 needs to be updated? And if so, how? And if not, why?
Sure. So I would argue, I mean, there's a few different things. One is, what is it that you're actually trying to accomplish? And Brian laid out a few different things that he's concerned about. And we can go through them one by one. I don't think Section 230, either repealing or reforming it, actually helps with any of the things that were laid out. So I think that Section 230, you know, I would keep it. I would, in fact, if I had a magic wand, this is never going to happen, I would expand its coverage. It's actually a lot more limited than people make it out to be. People think that it's this sort of wide blanket immunity. That's not actually the case. I would actually make it wider. But it is enabling a lot of really important, valuable things online that we would absolutely miss if it were changed. And the idea that changing it suddenly makes these companies act better is, I don't think, borne out by the realities of the legal structure and what would happen. We can go into the specifics of why, but the thing that I always try and get at is the key point of Section 230 is that it's just about placing the liability on those responsible for, you know, violating the law, for creating the violative content. So if it's defamation, which is sort of the classic case, who actually said the thing that is defamatory? If it's something else, who actually is creating that content that creates the problem that violates the law? All the law is doing is saying, we put the liability on that person, not this other tool that they used. We don't blame the telephone if somebody calls in a bomb threat. We don't blame Ford if somebody gets into a car accident of their, you know, because of their own driving activity. That is all that Section 230 is doing, is saying, put the liability on the person who's actually responsible.
But let me just ask you about this. And Brian, if you want to jump in too. Mm-hmm. My understanding, like when you talk about, and we can get to the sort of the analogy of the car. But if I'm walking down the street and I say, Jim Stevenson, who's not a public figure, that guy stole money. He is a thief. I'm not going to get sued for defamation or liable in any way, because there's no damages. because I'm just saying it on the street. I mean, maybe if I had said it to, you know, like his boss or something like that, and he got fired, maybe there's an argument there, but there's no damages. The reason why there's damages in these instances, because I did it on YouTube, and YouTube has an algorithm that may reward controversy and promote something, and then has the ability to project that to a million people. I mean, so how are they not in your, in the way that you have structured that, you've said like, it's gotta be, you know, hold people responsible for the crime. But what YouTube did there also actually creates the tortious, you know, one important element of a tort, which is the damages.
Yeah. So it is a different situation. There's no sort of perfect analogy, but the simple fact is that what role in that case YouTube plays is just the sort of distribution of content or the recommendation of content, neither of which, if you separate it out from the content itself, violates the law. So even in those scenarios, if you were able to sue YouTube, they would still be protected by the First Amendment, which would say that they are just sharing, or they're hosting the content, they're sharing the content, they're recommending the content, stripped of the specific content, which is what the law would do.
What if they're told, hey, what if I write in and go, hey, I am not a criminal, or Jim Stevens is not a criminal. Here's proof of it. He was acquitted, you know, and they're informed of it. Do they have liability then?
So that scenario, so there's a case, it depends on where you are. There are a bunch of very specifics, you know, within the scenario. So in most cases, what happens is if someone says, you know, people will always say like, oh, I didn't do it. If a company like YouTube is not in a position to know, they're not a court.
What if I was acquitted?
So in that case,
I mean, these things are provable.
Sure. So if you've gone through an entire court case and you have that ruling and you send it to YouTube, they will take that content down. That is actually something that all of the big companies will do. If there is a court case and there is a ruling,
but they're not obligated to.
They are not obligated to, but in almost every case, because they know it reflects very poorly on them, they will. And in fact, that has led to people going around faking lawsuits, faking rulings. There was a few years ago, there was this whole story of this reputation management company that was doing that.
But so, Brian, let's ask about that. So, you know, we're at that point where I think you might take issue, because it's really up to a reputation for YouTube here, but there's no legal, they are actually immune in that instance. I mean, if...
Yeah, I mean, Mike, I agree with you. Like, I agree with, like, very strong protections for all First Amendment protected speech. I just see more and more things coming out of these companies that does not appear to me to be First Amendment protected speech, but that has been protected and shielded from being litigated in court by Section 230. So, for instance, even just in the last week or so, there's this big case moving forward in New Mexico against Meta that the Attorney General is bringing for their negligence in protecting minors from being contacted by suspected groomers online. The Attorney General held a sting operation where he found that Meta like wasn't doing a lot to stop this. You know, one internal document that came out shows that the algorithm, and Meta knew this, was recommending the accounts of minors at a rate of 4 times to accounts that they had flagged as suspected groomers than to regular adults. So the algorithm was seeing that these suspected groomer accounts liked the accounts of minors more and recommended it 4 times as much. I'm just not sure that that is First Amendment protected speech that we need to have a shield around. And there's like a bunch of examples like that, you know,
but
that
can
have
I interject?
Been traditionally protected by Section 230.
Can I ask, though, is that but the behavior that you're describing there is criminal and is involves
Facebook's is not.
Sorry?
Facebook's, I'm not sure it is. It's a civil suit in New Mexico. And and it is true that criminal behavior is not protected by Section 230 or shielded by Section 230. But those civil courts have a really important role. Like, most criminal behavior is a really high bar. And First Amendment protected speech is also a really high bar in the criminal courts, which should apply. But that is not a criminal case against Facebook. But and traditionally, until this case moved forward on a product design case, you know, there was no recourse for, you know, and that is, I don't know, it's different than something we arranged
forward,
on a phone. I know, I'm curious what you think about that, Mike. Does that prove to you that Section 230 is working or that it, something has gone wrong, that it's moving forward? I'm genuinely curious.
Yeah, I mean, there are a bunch of these cases, and each one has different specifics, and I think that, you know, we could get into the deep weeds, but I don't think we
but
want
they're
to.
All broadly skirting Section 230 by arguing product liability, right? That's right. Generally the legal theory.
Where the fight is right now is that a lot of people are trying to get around 230 by arguing products liability. There may be some cases where I think that could be an interesting area to explore, but I think a lot of the cases are really, you know, they're just trying to get around 230 and they don't have a real case underlying it. They're just arguing that it's products liability. When you look at what is the product liability really for, and it gets back to the underlying content specifically, and then you get into a First Amendment case. You know, in certain situations, it's not always true, and each case is different. So it's, I don't know if we want to get specifically in there, but it is important that, like, for all the talk of, oh, 230 is giving these companies this blanket liability, we're seeing all of those product liability cases not get dismissed on 230 grounds and move forward. So I, you know, whether or not.
Yeah, but it's taken a long time. And we've talked to a bunch of the lawyers, and they say they expect these companies to keep bringing up 230. It's a constant hurdle that they're able to throw, you know, even once there's been a ruling that a case can move forward to a certain extent. So, and I would argue it, you know, it's taken this long to get these cases because of 230. I think it's hard to deny that.
So then is there a possibility of 230 being amended to say include some of, you know, what you're talking about there, Brian, which is facilitating something related to child abuse? I'm sorry, you can expand on an example again. But is it possible that you can amend it while still having the speech protections in place for, say, creators on these sites?
I mean, there's been a case study here that didn't go great, which maybe, Mike, we were about to bring up.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going.
You can take it. But there was one amending, basically, to Section 230 that carved out liability when knowingly facilitating sex trafficking, basically. And there were a bunch of unintended consequences, essentially, and it didn't really do a lot, arguably, to help sex traffickers or sex trafficking victims.
What were those unintended consequences?
Just to foster...
Yeah, so Sesta Fosta was the bill. And again, it's one of those things that sounds good in theory, which is obviously sex trafficking is bad. So we're going to carve out part of Section 230 doesn't apply to anything that is facilitating sex trafficking. But what that did in practice was it, you know, forced sex workers offline. There were various communities that they had or various services that they used that companies were saying, oh, we're going to get sued for this, and therefore we can't have you on these platforms. You had things like Craigslist shutting down their entire dating platform because they were afraid that if anyone used it for sex trafficking, that they would get held liable for it. You had eBay that was removing LGBTQ content because there was fear that they would be accused of sex trafficking. Even the very few lawsuits that have showed up under Sesta Fosta were sort of ridiculous. Salesforce.com got sued because they were providing the CRM for that back page used to manage their advertisers. And so they got accused of sort of very, very indirectly enabling sex trafficking. So there were a whole bunch of things. And even worse was that you actually had law enforcement, you had police come out and say that back when there were services like Backpage around, they actually cooperated with the police. And so if they were trying to track down actual sex traffickers, those tools were really useful. With Sesta Fosta sort of shutting down all of those internet services, it became actually harder to track down those who were actually engaging in sex trafficking. So you have to be very, very careful about how you calibrate these things, and sort of the consequences that come out of them can often be the opposite of what you actually want.
And we've touched on those failures of Sesta Fosta, I mean, I think concurrently too, you know, when that was up. But I want to get back to the part about it is in the best interests of these corporations, particularly the ones that have monopolies in many respects. But regardless, to respond if they're told, even though they have no liability associated with it, because I'm thinking about, I think it was Xeron versus AOL. This is a case where somebody, basically the scenario I had laid out, there was a Xeron, some guy was Kent, associated.
Guy living in his parents' house in Seattle, real estate agent.
Who was Xeron, who was somehow associated with the attack in Oklahoma.
He wasn't associated with
it. He was associated on these. He was random and he wasn't involved whatsoever, but he was associated by like some advertiser. I can't remember the exact details, but it had to do with like his number on some like.
It was like merch, like come to Oklahoma City, have a blast, like a month after the Oklahoma City bombing, and then it had his number on it.
Your perspective, Brian, I mean, you make the case as to why AOL should have had some liability there once they were told this was happening, and they didn't. Make that case that they should have, if that's your opinion.
I mean, I'd rather make the case with like a current like case. Like that's, honestly, like I think, like I don't know. I think about this story that Reuters just broke in the fall, where a reporter there, Jeff Horowitz, got a hold of. And this has to do with the same idea of like if a company knows something's happening and they're still not liable, like I think it gives you a picture of what it looks like inside a lot of these companies behind the shield of Section 230, which we're starting to get more of a picture of only because of whistleblowers and a few lawsuits moving forward. Otherwise, it's really hard to get that picture. And, you know, in the fall, Reuters broke this story where they got leaked a bunch of documents from inside Meta showing that Meta estimated that last year, they were going to make something like 10% of their overall revenue was going to be from scam ads for scams and banned goods that they knew were scammy and banned goods. I think like $16 billion. Their own, you know, internal like judgments made it like they're like a pillar of the scam fraud economy in America. Like a third of all fraud happens on Meta platforms. And some of the most shocking like data to me had to do with they have, you know, algorithms and ways of judging the likelihood that an ad or a account that's providing an ad is scammy. And it had to be over 95% sure in order for them to consider taking it down. So if it was 90% sure that this was a scam and it was going to steal their users' money, they left it up and they took money from the advertiser. And then something like, I have the number here, it's like they were getting they get 100,000 complaints from users about scam ads in a typical week, and they'd only look into 4,000 of them. And they know that they're making, you know, 10% of their revenue on this. So to me, that's a picture of what it's like when you don't have liability for your behavior.
Right. But
I want to just hear Michael. How does that justify it?
Yeah, so there are a bunch of specific things there too. So say you were to change the law, so say, okay, if you believe that there are, if you, you know, run this test to determine if there are scam ads on your platform, you will be liable. What is the first thing that lawyers, the you know, thousands of lawyers that Mark Zuckerberg employs will?
Well, I wouldn't write the law that way. I would say we're going to have a reasonable standard. We, you know, okay. This is not the concept of a reasonable standard in all aspects of the law is ones that we have. And that would be developed through case law. There could be maybe some statutory implication. But, you know, I think if you have, you know, I think we can all agree looking into 4% of scam complaints. It's probably lower than we think is reasonable. Maybe looking into 99.9%. Maybe that's a little bit much to ask, but if you have a 95% assuredness, and we now know, we could also obligate companies like you got to run a reasonable assuredness of scams. Yeah. If you
one expert who I really respect, like her proposal, is that you lose the immunity of Section 230 if you show a deliberate indifference to this type of content. Which,
I mean,
to me, that's what those numbers show.
So let's take an example like that. So if you do that, suddenly you're making it so that basically the only company that will host those kinds of ads at all are the largest companies in the world. And I actually think part of the problem is that these companies are way too powerful, and we need, you know, more smaller companies and smaller communities out there. But doing
let's
it
put
this
a, let's
way,
put a requirement on it. I mean, we do this in OSHA and other things. If you have a certain amount of employees, if you're a certain amount of revenue, if you have a certain amount of users, we could easily do that, right?
Sure. But again, like immediately then you begin to bring up all sorts of issues with that, where, you know, we see that in other instances where then companies start to game that and you have subsidiaries and all these things, everyone starts to game it, but it just creates more, you know, more compliance costs, more legal issues that generally the larger companies are able to handle and the smaller ones aren't, even if it's just like, you know, okay, well, if you're smaller, we let you out, but you still have to be then monitoring how close you're getting. There's all sorts of things that get into it. I'm not saying it's the worst solution in the world. It's better than certainly some that people are talking about, but it creates all of these compliance costs that historically we see that tends to lead to more consolidation and more power of the biggest guys who are able to have the building full of lawyers who can handle
it. How can we have more consolidation?
you absolutely could. There are more internet companies out there than Facebook and Google, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I'm compelled by this a little bit because I think what we're talking about here is there's a major issue of scale and the amount of content that is constantly posted on these platforms. And my deep concern here as we're talking this through is how are this incentivizes broader censorship, in my view, maybe, because these corporations are going to take the stance, it would seem to me, of more censorship because they don't have the capacity to monitor all of the posting on their platform. And so it means that broader rules are going to be what protects them from more liability, which is more censorship and stricter rules in terms of what content can be published. Like, why are we even go? My question is, why can't we go about regulating these companies outside of the auspices of Section 230 that doesn't give this incentive to these corporations?
Yeah, I would say it's in some ways it's even worse than that, because it's not just that the companies will put in place more rules and be more aggressive about it, but it gives effectively a heckler's veto for any particular content, because if there's any content that someone doesn't want out there, and let me tell you, there are tons of people who don't want certain content out there, they just send a legal threat. And it's the threat alone is often enough for the company to say, man, you know, the risk of having to fight this or argue back on it, if that is a $5-10 million, let's exactly. just take down the content. And so you do mm-hmm. get a vast censorship regime. And I think you're exactly right. There are other levers out there that aren't 230. I don't know why everyone has zoomed in on this one law as if changing it somehow fixes the problems that we see, because there are problems. You know, I think all of us agree that we don't like this world in which a company like Facebook or Google have as much power as they have. And I think that the focus on 230 is misguided, because there are things out there. There are privacy laws we could have that I think would be really helpful. There's antitrust enforcement, obviously, that I think would be helpful if done well. I think a lot of it has been done in a very messy way. There's a whole other law that I think is actually more important in all of this, and I'm going to bring it up, even though we could go down a whole other rabbit hole, but the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, I think, is the worst law that has really led to most of these problems. Brian, if you want to do a whole podcast mm-hmm. on why we should fix the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, I would do that. There was a whole situation where someone built a company to try and help people get their data out of Facebook. And Facebook sued them, saying they violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and won and killed that company. But getting your own data out of Facebook seems like a good thing that would enable more competition to exist. And they were able to shut it down. So I think there are other laws that we should focus on. Messing with 230 is just a recipe for.
I mean, I would love for regulation to work. It's just it's hard to. First of all, like, when you think about what the FCC is up to right now, or do we really want to be empowering them to have more of a of a lever over these companies that are already doing bidding without it, you know?
But that's what changing 230 would do that, right? I mean, that would give the FCC more power right now. Like, the first sort of review of 230 in 2020 was by the FCC.
Would the FCC would it give the FCC more power to regulate, or would it simply allow for more civil action?
It depends. I mean, because technically, as we said at the beginning, the 230 is in the Communications Act, which is you know, the FCC's authority. You know, there is an argument, but the in 2020, the FCC under the, in the first Trump regime made the argument that they had the authority to interpret Section 230 and determine how different websites should or should not be using 230 as a, you know, as a tool. Mm-hmm. And so any messing with 230 in some sense can go back to the FCC to determine, to interpret how that law should be enacted. And right now we have someone in Brendan Carr who will absolutely use that. And he made it clear in 2020, you can look back at what Brendan Carr said about 230 in 2020 and see what he would do if we were to amend 230 now.
But Brian,
it
can I just ask
that you, is like, you know, yeah.
Yeah, no, you can respond. I just wanted to ask you a more direct question about mm-hmm. this, but keep going.
I was going to say, like, it is true that that is in, for instance, Project 2025. You know, empowering the FCC to interpret Section 230. To me, I gravitate more towards reforms that give agency to more Americans to bring suits and make a case in court. I'm worried about the consolidation of rules and regulations in authorities like the FCC in this area that does involve a lot of speech. That concerns me, frankly.
So my question there is, if we're looking at the perspective of, like, say, a Facebook or a publisher or a YouTube, right? Google, whatever.
They're not a publisher. That's
Sorry.
They are. No, well, this
they
is,
are,
this
but
is,
they
this
can't
is,
be
this
held liable.
Really
they can't be held liable.
This is, all right. Yeah. So everyone gets into this thing where they think, like, oh, if, you know, 230 means you're not a publisher. No, it means you are. They're encouraging you to do publishing activities, to edit, to recommend, to take down. Those are all publishing activities. The whole idea is that you get to do publishing activities. You get to be a publisher without being held liable as a publisher.
Exactly. So but the amount of content that is being produced on mm-hmm. these platforms on a daily basis is it's so much, right? It's impossible mm-hmm. to tally. Is it not the most obvious incentive for these tech companies to create as many restrictions, to have a large umbrella that restricts the content that is published on their site if Section 230 is repealed, to avoid the constant litigation that is going to be involved here, which has the effect of severely limiting speech? Like, where is it not in, if Section 230 is repealed, is it not their direct financial in their direct financial incentives or best interests to do what I'm describing here?
I mean, repeal and reform could be different things, but let's take the drastic, like, repeal version. I'm not convinced of that. None of us know what a world without Section 230 in the internet would be like. We haven't had it in any sense of the modern internet. I think it's very possible that the profit motive with some of these companies is so strong that it wouldn't change drastically. It might change some. And also, like, I think there's a conflation sometimes with Section 230 and the First Amendment, which I love and, like, desperately want to protect. The First Amendment doesn't protect tech companies and social media companies and the scale of speech that we have necessarily.
But I'm talking about the profit motive too. But my point is that if they're tied up in litigation constantly, does that not affect their bottom line in the same way that you're talking about? If not more than...
Yes, no, I think there'd be changes, but I don't know that it'd be as draconian a censorship regime as you're imagining. We don't know.
That's what's concerning, talking about a time period before there was this amount of consolidation amongst tech companies where, like, it worked for a little while until there was...
Sure, but
this
right now, I mean, take the flip side. I'm like you have TikTok is now owned by Larry Ellison and River Murdoch and whoever else. So they can do whatever censorship regime they want.
Well, I was just going
to
argue
that it's completely opaque. We have
recourse to sue
and get discovery and see what's happening. So I think there's two ways to think about it. Like, right,
I mean,
now, yeah.
I just to reiterate Brian's point and add to this, from my perspective, like, every sort of apocalyptic vision we have of them being overly concerned because they're going to get sued, it's already existing now.
But that's ideological.
With people who, no, not just ideological.
With TikTok.
No, but in YouTube. I mean, I can tell you.
Yeah, like, they reinstated Donald Trump's like account and gave him money rather than exercising their Section 230 prerogative to keep him off the platform.
But I will also just say, like, as a commercial thing, like, you know, having gone through the ad apocalypse, having gone through all of this stuff, I know that YouTube has different rules for different content creators. I mean, it is completely like there is the idea that it's just like we let everything go. No, they have their own set of rules in which they do this stuff. There is no recourse whatsoever. And so the idea that somehow specific types of we're talking about a fear that it's going to chill. They're going to like take a hatchet and be censorious in that way because they want to be afraid. They're afraid of being sued. I'm not convinced that they would do that and that they're not doing that now. I mean, the reason why they don't want the obligation of having to moderate on this level and why the idea was this is going to make it safe for these companies to moderate is because they don't want to expend the manpower that it would require because it cuts into their bottom line. And what I'm suggesting would, I think, undermine a lot of businesses in various ways. I don't necessarily have a problem with that in the same way that, like, when I was on radio, I'm like, let's put the fairness doctrine back in. Yes, it creates a burden, but so...
Like I'd be interested to see these business models if they have to take into account some liability the way that I do and you guys do on your show.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
But I think your Brian is overstating the case that we don't know what happens if we change it, because we do have examples of other regimes. And in particular, in the US, we have the DMCA in the copyright world, because copyright is exempted from Section 230. And we see what happens with copyright. There's all sorts of things where content gets taken down based on bogus DMCA claims all the time. And in fact, the fact that you're on YouTube, that YouTube is basically the only platform for video that is big enough to be out there that everyone uses, is the direct result of a DMCA regime that is problematic, because there was a really big competitor called Veo, which was backed by Michael Eisner and was supposed to be the big winner because it had the Hollywood backing. And they got sued under the DMCA, and the case went on for many, many years, and they won. But by the time they won, they were dead. They had spent all this money fighting the case, and YouTube was the only one left standing because of that. So we have that example. We have in Europe, they have under the GDPR, they have this thing called the right to be forgotten. And there have been studies on how many people have used the right to be forgotten to try and get content taken down. And the studies show that over 50% of the requests are illegitimate, but the companies feel obligated because they don't want to go through the process of having to litigate every one of these things. Same thing with the DMCA. There was a study, it's a little bit old now, but there was a study of DMCA requests, and that showed that over 50%, I think it was like over 60% of them, were false DMCA requests. They were not legitimate copyright takedowns, but companies still take it down because they don't want to face the liability issue. When you change that regime, you're giving people a tool to take down content, or you're creating this massive amount of compliance work that is going on. We're waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on a DMCA case right now. That also is representatives. If you increase the liability, you create real difficulties for companies that want to host content to the point that only the biggest companies will be able to do it.
I am very sympathetic as an entity that has been sued for the most ridiculous of things. From a copyright standpoint, and had to settle because it's like, I don't have the resources to go up against it. I'm very sympathetic to that. However, and frankly, just more coincidentally than anything else, I'd like to loosen copyright laws, not because of the lawsuits, but because I think I would like to see this information be free. But it seems to me that, you know, with any compliance, like building codes, it's a pain in the ass. But then again, the building stays up, or is more likely to. Honestly, that like there's trade-offs. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. The question is like, what are we trading off? And, you know, I'm not just concerned about like sort of the health of a business per se. I'm concerned more about the health of a society. And you have to make a determination that our structure that exists now is creating a overwhelming benefit to society that we can't tweak in some way. And I find that hard to believe in this era that, I mean, there's one vision of the internet in 1996, and then it's what it looks like today. And it's pretty hard to argue that because in the absence of the civil system for enforcing moderation of some form, right? We're getting other entities that are in many ways worse. You follow me? Like, it would
be
nice.
Can I offer a heady thought that, like, has affected my thinking? Because, you know, this has been an evolution for me, too. Like, I have generally had a very absolutist view of, like, more speech is better. The more, you know, you answer speech that you don't like with more speech. But I heard in an interview with a reporter named Natalia Antolava, who makes the case that the noise is the new censorship, that like the volume of content and the overwhelm of content is actually a new form of censorship. And it helps me to think about that and to not just think as, you know, of like kind of an overly traditionally censorious company as the only way that we're being, that the ability to speak and to have speech register, you know, is being overwhelmed, and that the tools of the internet are being co-opted by wannabe authoritarian regimes. And it's been helpful to keep in mind, and like has played a role in my thinking as well.
But even if that's true, even if we accept that, and I think there is some truth to that to some extent, the way to deal with that has been historically algorithmic recommendations, which is one of the things that many people are now pushing to exempt from 230, which will create all, you know, won't help that situation, will actually make it worse. The ability to have the good stuff rise to the top and get rid of the you know, to find the signal in the noise is the, you know, the way it's often phrased, is you need the tools to do that. And if you don't have a 230 protecting that, then there's a liability risk, right? There are a whole bunch of people who say,
are there accountability mechanisms you can imagine, Mike, that would give us more accountability over the algorithms? So, and not just like hoping that there's like kind of like more user control, but actual, I don't know, regulation or
yeah,
or,
I was going to say, like,
legislation.
How is the algorithmic conventions that we're living under now helping in that way as opposed to hurting?
Well, right. I mean, it depends. So one, it can always be worse. So be careful about what you wish for. This is what we found.
If you get rid of algorithms, the algorithm's not going
to
be worse.
No, but it is true. Well, like you could use an algorithm to you know, screen out deepfake, you know, intimate images, for instance.
Right.
That's a use of an algorithm, which is a good use. Yeah.
Right. I mean, like
not a profitable one.
No, but no, to some extent it is, right? I mean, like every trust and safety team right now uses algorithmic tools to handle things, including searching for and getting rid of CSAM and reporting it to NCMEC. And like these things matter. But there are studies. There was a study done by NYU a few years ago that looked at, they sort of forced people into not using algorithmic feeds, and they found that they saw more disinformation because the tools actually tend to filter out some of the disinformation. But the real thing to me is sort of who controls these things, right? What I want is for more users to have control over the algorithm and what it is that they want to see, that they can indicate to the algorithms, or they can design the algorithms themselves or have options over what algorithms. The problem comes when the only person who has control over the algorithm is Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg. But that's not a 230 issue.
Well, it could be. You could leverage 230 to do that.
I don't see how. I mean, again, like you begin to get back to a First Amendment question in terms of, you know, it is an editorial decision-making thing of, you know, what content we recommend.
Yeah, but you're just saying you don't get immunity. It's not a First Amendment issue if you're just saying you don't get 230
immunity. But then you get back to the same thing, which is what we started this out with, is, okay, so you take away that. You still have the First Amendment to rely on. People are going to sue. There's going to be all of these lawsuits, and the only companies that can afford those lawsuits are the big ones.
Well,
how do you get companies to do what you're saying, to give users more control rather than kind of like shouting?
I mean, there are other mechanisms beyond just the law, right? Beyond just the regulation. So in my case, like I'm working with Blue Sky to encourage them to do it. They have algorithms that you can choose. You can make your own. You can do what you want with it. And if we see more people saying like, oh, that is a better solution, one that I will adopt, then that that puts pressure on other companies to.
Well, that's where we. That's where we'll have it. That's the rub. Is but Mike, I mean, I was so with you until the like basically we can't. No, we have to compel corporations to do that. I mean, there's
yeah, it can't be a hope and a wish.
But how do you do that? But if you want to do that, how do you do that with the First Amendment in place? Right.
But do it without. I mean, but it seems like the solution, guys. It seems like the solution is doing this outside of Section 230, and like I'm just a little bit more skeptical about the idea that civil liability in and of itself is going to be the thing that is a solution here. It seems like it's anti-monopoly and congressional regulation. That's the solution.
Section 230 is congressional regulation. It is one that says they're not subject. I can give an example on how you leverage Section 230. Is that to get the Section 230 protection, you need to do X, Y, and Z. You need to provide this amount of transparency in the algorithm. Like if Twitter wants Section 230 protection, they need to provide the same amount of transparency as Blue Sky does in terms of the algorithm. That's one way to leverage it. Another way to leverage it is to say, like, you know, I mean, those to me, you could say, there's a strict level of liability where there's an opportunity where things can be dismissed easily in a summary judgment if these basic requirements haven't been fit. I mean, I think like the chastity around Section 230 is where I have a difference is I am willing to pay the price for some regulation and constraint on these things, because in my mind, it evens the playing field for corporations. Right now, what it you're talking play. About, in my estimation, happens already with corporations. It just happens based upon where you're situated.
No, I will reinforce this over and over again. It changing 230 in the way that you're talking about gives way more power to the big companies, because the changes that you're talking about, things around like transparency and stuff, you still run into the First Amendment problem. And Facebook will walk in.
What is the First Amendment problem?
The transparency in terms of what you recommend, the First Amendment issue is could the government go to Fox News and say, we need transparency into how you choose which stories you lead with?
Fox News doesn't have immunity in that respect.
Yeah, just for
I'm talking about the First Amendment, though.
Because, I'm sorry, this is different. Because Section 230 is a carve-out in liability, in tort liability law. And the government can put a requirement as to what makes you eligible for that carve out. This is not a restriction on free speech. You will have exactly the same rights that Fox News has and obligations.
Okay. So, but we already have a case like this, which is in California. They passed this age appropriate design code, which tried to do something like that, which was trying to require transparency in algorithms. And it was thrown out on First Amendment grounds because they said the real reason behind it was an attempt to interfere in the editorial decision.
That's why you need to leverage 230, because 230 does not exist in nature. 230 is not in the Constitution. So if you want 230 protections, you must meet certain standards.
But the standards that you're setting there involve speech, and the First Amendment is going to apply. So okay, so let's use that mechanism that you want, but why do you have to focus it on 230? What if you change the mechanism? What if you say that it's antitrust law? What if you get a freedom from antitrust law if you make the algorithms transparent? There are other tools out there. Again, like focus on 230.
I want them subject to antitrust law.
We live in the world. It's not happening.
It's different than Fox News being a publisher than the amount of millions and millions billions of people who are publishing on these sites, Sam. So that's the difference here is that like...
That's just like a too big to fail argument.
We're not talking about journalism and journalistic standards. We're talking about billions and billions of people posting all the time and creating an incentive for a mega corporation to broadly censor because they want to avoid liability. This is why I don't understand why this conversation is purely within the context of civil liability. It feels like the wrong area.
What other area?
The other area is congressional regulation, additional congressional regulation
regulation makes the basis for the civil.
I understand that that's the basis for Section 230, but I'm saying that basically you can have it in terms of like both regulating the algorithms to a degree. You can go around it, and what I listed before, now I'm completely blanking on, but I'm confused a little bit as to why this is the basis for.
Here's why, Emma, I think of it that way. One of the ways I think about it, and listen, I'm open to other ideas. I just don't see, you know, like I haven't seen like really compelling paths there. Section 230 is this extra thing that Congress gave to this class of internet service providers, and it is this stick that you can use. Once you start having Congress make laws about what, like they can't make laws about what content is harmful or not. Like to me, that is where I get tripped up. Like, what is Congress going to do? They're going to say this type of content, we have to be able to see the algorithm. Like, I don't want them doing that. You know, I would much rather like take the framework that we've had for a long time in other scenarios and kind of import more of that. We have this relatively new framework that's 30 years old for the internet that goes beyond, in a lot of cases, very strong First Amendment protections. Michael, and yes, it might mean a less volume of speech. The First Amendment doesn't protect that volume of speech necessarily. Like, it doesn't mean that you have a right to get algorithmically boosted to millions of people. That is not protected by the First Amendment.
Michael, the let me ask you this as an analogy.
Something.
Yeah.
We provide gun manufacturers immunity from torts that involve the design of their product that if used correctly in a way that we don't for car manufacturers, in a way that we don't for other machine, whatever. I mean, I think it's rather unique. Do you think that's a fair analogy?
No. Guns aren't speech. I mean, that's what it comes down to, right? We're talking about regulating speech. That's what this is. Everything on the internet in some form or another is speech.
Then why do we need 230?
But Mike, even like even an algorithm. Why would we need 230
if it's First Amendment? I mean, if right. 230. Yeah.
No, that is a good question. And it's a question that comes up. A lot of people will say, well, if all you're saying is true, that this all goes back to the First Amendment, why do you need 230 in the first place? And the simple fact is that 230 is a procedural benefit to the First Amendment. What it does is it gets the cases that would lose on First Amendment grounds tossed out at the earliest stage when it is less expensive. What if you want to do a First Amendment case, that you have to go through summary judgment, you might have to go through trial. Someone figured this out recently in terms of like the difference of cost. If you're using 230 to get out of these cases, it's in the range of $50,000 to $100,000, which is expensive for me at least, but like for a larger company, that's doable. If you want to win the exact same case, which you will win on First Amendment grounds, you're talking $5 to $10 million. So at that range, it becomes existential for smaller companies. And so you make it impossible for smaller companies to exist, and you put more power in the hands. If you're just relying on the First Amendment, you are giving much more power to the biggest companies. If you have 230 as this procedural benefit that allows you to get out of these cases at the earliest stage very quickly and say, you can't bring this case because 230 protects it, you can have smaller companies, you can have competitors, you can have new entrants into the marketplace, and you can take away from the dominance of the Googles and Facebooks of the world.
And 230 is written perfectly in that respect.
I think any messing with it will almost certainly make it worse. Every attempt I've seen at reforming it will make it worse. If you can show me a reform that makes it better, I am open to it. I'm happy to talk about it. I have not seen one yet.
Brian, do
you think there's any way you like, and I'm genuinely curious, I'm like, if you replace 230 with a national anti-slap,
that is about the closest. I've thought about that. I've talked about that a lot. I think one that would help. One, I think we should have a national anti-slap law. We should have an anti-slap law in every state. And I think that they should be stronger and do more, even
anti-slap laws, just for people who don't, are laws about bringing frivolous lawsuits and ones that are meant to intimidate.
Yeah. It's a similar procedural tool that's state by state, right, where, you know, if you get sued for speech that's clearly like the lawsuit is vexatious, you can get it thrown out.
Right. And make the other side pay your legal fees in some cases, which I think is really important as well.
Do you think like that as a replacement would solve some problems?
I think that would solve some problems. I don't think it would solve all of the problems. I still think you would want something 230-like to handle a class of problems that 230 has protected that an anti-SLAPP law would be more difficult to in terms of how they protect. Also, to get an anti-SLAPP successfully has proven to be fairly difficult. The procedural benefits of 230 still stick in place. If you look at how anti-SLAPP laws have developed and how they're being used and where they're being used, it's been harder to actually enforce or make the anti-SLAPP laws useful. And so like maybe there's a world in which you could build out the anti-SLAPP regime, but I think what you would end up doing is effectively getting back to 230 to make it that effective in the first place. But yeah, like that would be
the thing I'm trying to solve for is like I feel uncomfortable saying we have to accept an algorithm that feeds minors at a higher rate to groomers in order to preserve free speech online, or we have to accept like a website that is facilitating illegal gun sales that are then used to kill people as speech in order to protect speech online. Like there has to be a way to thread this needle.
That's specifically referring to Arms List. Which we should just talk about, and we're running out of time here. We've gone a little bit long, but I find it fascinating. And so, what are you going to do? Sometimes
wonky, but good. I appreciate it.
the algorithm part. If algorithms were not given 230 grease or protection, however you want to refer to that. Your problem with that is just that the absence of algorithms aren't going to help, or is there some other problem with it, Mike?
There's a few things. One, the absence of algorithms won't help in the way that people think they will help. There's lots of people who insist that algorithms are just inherently bad. They don't realize how much they actually do rely on algorithms, and algorithms are, in fact, very useful. You know, search itself is an algorithm. Finding the stuff that you want is important.
So broadly speaking, it won't be, do you think it's problematic in some other way?
So, yeah, I mean, again, it gets back to if you were to exempt them, who is actually going to be willing to still go through the process of using algorithms that will be useful for people? And it's the big companies because they can afford the legal liability. And again, so therefore, you're putting more power in the hands of a Facebook and a Google and less in the hands of smaller upstart competitors. And I think the world needs more upstart competitors that can chip away at Google and Facebook dominance.
Can Mike, we agree on antitrust? How about antitrust?
I'm all for antitrust, but antitrust is slow and messy and has been wielded by, you know, not well by our government. I think there are ways to reform that and change that and make that better.
But 230 isn't necessarily leading to more. Yeah, 230, we've lived under a 230 regime. And let's be clear on what's happened with the internet. It's gone like this. It's not gone like that. I mean, it's gone in one direction,
It can be worse. Is what I'm saying. There are new companies that show up all the time that are trying to chip away at these companies. You don't see that as much in the copyright space. YouTube is the dominant and only player. You don't really see competitors showing up for YouTube because you have this worse liability regime in copyright under the DMCA that nobody else can really handle other than YouTube.
Yeah.
Okay. In the Arms List, just address the Arms List case. This is a story where someone was able to use Arms List, which was almost like a Craigslist, I guess, mm-hmm. right? But for
it was a marketplace for guns online.
For guns, yeah. And there was no sort of moderation as to whether this is an illegal sale or a non-illegal sale. And somebody bought a gun at like a McDonald's from somebody, and then went out and shot somebody.
Shot his wife or his ex-wife and multiple other people. And then they tried to sue Arms List for liability in Section 230 protected. And I just wonder if if somebody was putting up posters.
Well, Michael, address that. Like, what is that? Is that a good thing about 230 or?
Well, I mean, I don't think that the scenario is good. Well, I do think 230 was used properly in that case, and I actually filed an amicus brief in that case. I do think that did come back to a 230 issue, because if you were to set it up where anyone who was a marketplace was potentially liable for the sales that were made, for what is then done off platform and outside of that, you create a world in which no one will offer you any marketplace service at all, or it will only be Facebook again. You will only have a Facebook marketplace. So I think you need to sort of recognize what is the and again, we can look at what happened with Fosta Sesta. As soon as there was liability, we lost all of these other services that we actually, I think a lot of us thought were very valuable and important services that got taken away. And so you can say like, yes, here's this one bad use, really problematic use. But like, we have criminal law to deal with the fact that someone went and shot someone. And like, that's where that should apply, rather than trying to throw in this other thing like, oh, we also get to sue the marketplace.
I mean, gun control largely is built upon the idea that we're not just going to wait till someone shoots somebody. It is that we're going to inhibit the sales of guns outside of specific channels.
Right. And then, but you know, then you have the whole Second Amendment issue, and we're already spending so much time talking on the First Amendment. Right. I don't want to.
Like, what do you think about this idea? Like, I'm sure you know her, but this professor, Marianne Franks, like, sure. Her proposal is, and I believe she worked in the Armsless case, is to change the word information in the first part of Section 230 to speech. She argues that the word information is as what it, you don't get liability for, is too wide and actually goes beyond First Amendment protected speech and is what allows like an arms list scenario to happen. Like, would we really consider someone putting up posters on like telephone poles in your neighborhood saying, come get a gun, I won't check you, you know, if that's First Amendment protected speech? And then number two, you know, putting this basically saying like, you don't get the immunity if you can demonstrate that there was deliberate indifference to harmful content. And again, harmful would not be defined by Congress. It would be litigated in court.
Yeah, I think that there would be, it would be very difficult to have that actually work. I think the distinction between information and speech that Marianne makes is one that I've never seen a court agree with. I mean, if she can get a court to agree with it, that'd be interesting, mm-hmm. but I've never seen that. The courts look at, is this expressive in some form or another? And whether that is information or directly speech, I haven't seen them make that distinction. I think it's interesting that she's suggested that, but I don't quite understand why she thinks, especially this particular Supreme Court, would ever buy into that. And so it's interesting. I appreciate that Marianne is out there trying different ideas, mm-hmm. but that one.
What about the second part, which I think is the more important part? You know,
explain the second one again.
You lose immunity if it's shown that you had a deliberate indifference. To me, that's Facebook essentially getting 100,000 complaints about scam ads and essentially taking action on none of them.
So
would be deliberate indifference. You know,
again, like, I think that becomes really tricky in practice, because as soon as you enter this possibility of saying, well, oh, okay, you were indifferent to the potential harm, you have now taken away the procedural benefit of Section 230 that we talked about, because everyone will sue and say, no matter what your decision was, you were procedurally indifferent. And if you can get past that motion to dismiss stage, which was the inexpensive out, and then you have to go through to summary judgment, you make it really expensive, and therefore you again create that sort of censorship regime where you just send the threat, and the fact that we can take you to court and we're going to cost you $1 million, it's easier to just remove the content.
I don't know. How's it different? We
have to wrap this up.
Some actual malice.
We've got to wrap this up. But yeah. I would deal with that by saying this applies to companies that have $100 million a year revenue. I mean, yes, you always have that problem, but we're going to pretend like we're $99 million and we're going to be six different companies. But we deal with that in the law all the time. But we're going to have to save this for another day. Not 30 years from now, but maybe on the next anniversary. This has been very helpful for me.
Yeah.
Although I haven't changed my mind. I'll
keep working on it.
Yes.
You won the over.
I'm not a free speech absolutist, A. And B, the expansion of free speech and to protect corporate rights, I think, is actually has its own dangers when it comes to all sorts of things like OSHA and labor laws. But that's for another day. Brian Reed, Michael Masnick, will put links to both of your shows and Tech Dirt and KCRW, and obviously we'll give your Blue Sky handles as well. Thanks so much, guys. Really, really appreciate it.
Thanks. This was fun,
everybody.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right, folks.
It reminded me a little bit of when I first started here. I think I had some skepticism about we had a small debate about, which I think was like if a bar owner should be able to be sued if somebody gets really drunk at the bar and then drives drunk and kills somebody.
It is a similar. It is a.
And
there's that, something similar. And I said yes. And you said no.
I didn't say no. I don't necessarily like I understood Bernie Sanders for not basically supporting the fact that gun manufacturers be able to be sued based on how people use their weaponry.
Oh, I definitely think you should be able to be sued because it's a carve out from every other utility that we have, supposedly on Second Amendment grounds. I don't buy that.
I'm more like ambivalent about that. I guess I'm just I'm curious about like I'm a little more skeptical of like the civil litigation being able to solve some of these problems like this. But I know you go to the tour conference twice a year.
I go to the tour conference.
It's hard for me to make
fundamentally
this case to you.
Don't believe that.
I know. I know.
I go on to playgrounds and I see that those rubber mats in New York City, that is a function of tort law. Everything we know about cigarettes, function of tort law.
I'm not saying it doesn't have a very important place, but with some of these trickier questions, where like it is, it's legal to buy a gun. Does it make sense that the gun manufacturer should be held liable for how the person uses it? I'm not sure that that's something that I believe.
If you can design a gun so that a five-year-old can't get it and accidentally shoot themselves, I think there's an obligation to do so.
I agree.
But that is.
But I mean, then that comes like, but that you can go at that through regulation or you can go at that through civil liability. But we have a corrupted Congress that isn't going to do that.
Well, the distinction you're making is not as cut and dry. Like the civil liability would exist, but in fact we do have that regulation. There is laws that basically say you can't manufacture a product that's going to be harmful in and of its nature if it's used properly.
Yeah,
and the gun immunity is actually another law that exempts the guns from that obligation. Same with 230.
It's a more extreme example, but I think 230 presents, repealing it presents way more problems than even that scenario that we're talking about here, which is like what it incentivizes these mega corporations that have such monopoly power over our platforms to regulate in terms of what's posted on their platforms. I mean, that's my fear. That's my fear.
Well, that was Masnick's point.
He won me over. Yeah.
All right. I guess
it's weird seeing a debate on this show that doesn't devolve into like a libertarian screaming at Sam.
I mean, I'm being slightly libertarian about some of this stuff.
It is a little bit libertarian-ish to me. That is like when we're waiting on corporations to do the right thing.
Meanest thing you've ever said to me.
Well, I wasn't talking about you. I was talking about Masnick, but you're like second order.
Sure.
Second order stuff.
Sure.
I'm fencing, but I'll go. I'm basically authoritarian against the copyright claims person. So whoever can get those out of my hair, I will be behind.
No, I'm open for loosening that. But I think like property's being protected. I think with the 230 and with the copyright laws, frankly, like I think there's a reason why you know. But all right, what should we do?
It's 1:40, so we're probably doing a freebie.
We're doing a freebie Wednesday.
Wow.
Yes, a freebie Wednesday.
Can I quickly take a break then for just a second?
Sure. Go ahead. I'll read some IMs. Triple flops. Mom and Dad are fighting. David Dave O. Down Dunder. lawyer, I don't even know her. Tubbo Flink, happy Friends Day Wednesday, folks. The U.S. doesn't have a government. It has a bunch of Call of Duty addled 12-year-olds pretending to be a government. To make matters worse, Chuck Schumer's attitude is effectively Mein Führer, the power to increase the use of gas chambers lives with the Reichstag, while Starmer appears to be determined to be remembered as Tony Blair without the charisma. Colonel Berner, we get it, Sam. You hate freedom and you hate America. Sickle Up Economy. That was a great chat with a lot of compassion. Good on you for having it. Definitely think the algorithms need oversight, especially in social media. Me too. Me too. Cole from Little Rock. Don't know if you saw this, but an Arkansas county elected the sheriff last night who is awaiting trial for murder. Most folks down here praise the man without stopping to think what they're asking for the Wild West when you're free to use violence, whether or not it's lawful.
Well, the thing that people forget about the Wild West is that often, including figures like Wyatt Earp, would impose a strict gun control regimen on new entrants to the town where you'd have to check in with the actual sheriff. And actually, that's my position on the Second Amendment. I think people should have a right to guns, but I think you should have to deal with the game and fish departments, and we shouldn't even have private gun sales.
Cauliflower, Brad Landers called out for reforming the Supreme Court in and adding additional seats. Let's see more of this from politicians.
Okay, Brad.
Kaju Beetle says, wow, Sam, take it back. Sorry, you believe we should have IDs in order to operate a toaster.
Oh, remember that? The 2016 Libertarian Convention?
Yes.
Vermin Supreme? That was my guy.
I remember him as much. I remember the freaking toaster guy, the seatbelts. We should.
Vermin Supreme was the guy who wore the boot on his head. That's all I remember.
Molly Jedi. We want to hear alpha males are back.
Oh well. Sorry, we're not going to the fun half today.
Henry, another daily reminder for to clip the soundboard saying nasty, very nasty. Sam saying nasty, very nasty. Ad hominy, since when is attacking someone first defense? Marco the Brazilian,
isn't
good
that
news.
The rule of prison?
That's the way. You tell me.
Yes, Sam, it is the rule.
Are you sure you don't mean rule of jail? Of county jail?
That's just boot camp for prison.
Marco the Brazilian, good news. Nashville City Council blocked Elon Musk from building a stupid, boring company tunnel. Sweet.
Oh, really? I mean, it's crazy. I just saw a groundbreaking for a Australian subway tunnel. That looks so much more impressive than anything Elon Musk has done. And we...
Do they have multiple cars going through it at the same time, or is it just one?
It's actually going to be a giant train carrying multiples of people that could fit in a car.
But wouldn't it be much easier if you had just like 12 cars, right? Each holding
lane?
One person?
We live in a cargo cult.
Let's get to our friend Chuck Schumer. Here is...
I sent this clip in our Slack last night with some expletives. That gives you an indication of what we're about to watch.
Chuck Schumer is reportedly now trying to prep the Senate. Now, understanding, if you're going to have more funding coming from the Senate... obviously also from the House, for, let's say, a supplement to fund all of the new bombs that we need to buy to drop on Iranians for their freeance and peeance, you're going to need a veto-proof majority in the Senate to pass this. In the House, theoretically, there's still enough Republicans to pass it without any Democratic votes, although I'm sure there'll be a couple. In the Senate, Fetterman, it sounds like, is willing to vote for as many new weapons as possible. And this is based upon what is anticipated for the War Powers Act. all the Republicans will vote for it except for Rand Paul.
Maybe Mike Lee.
That dude. Forget that dude. He's not even pretending anymore. Are scheduled to vote against the War Powers Resolution. But it gives you a little bit of a preview of money that is going to be given. Now, why would you, if you were voting to enforce the War Powers Act, that Congress needs to sign off on this, why would you then support more money for the war that you said is not is illicit because you haven't gotten congressional approval? Well, if you were really confused and had only one agenda and your name was Chuck Schumer, that's the answer to that question. Here he is talking about preventing a nuclear. Oh, what is that country that starts with an I?
Do you think Israel, you know, forced the U.S.'s hand here, boxed the U.S. in on this?
Look, no one wants a nuclear war. No one wants a nuclear Israel, but we certainly don't want an endless war, plain and simple. What did I say?
Nuclear Israel.
Oh, no. Got it. Let me say that again. No one wants an endless war, but we certainly don't want a nuclear Iran. That's for sure. Okay.
Now, you know what's interesting about, I mean, aside from the fact that he made a little Freudian slip there.
Yeah, there's only one country in the Middle East that has nukes, and that is Israel.
What's interesting is in the second formulation sounds a lot worse to me than the first formulation. Right? I mean, in the first formulation, he's saying we don't want, and he meant to say an Iran with nuclear weapons. Now, of course, he's the guy who voted against the Iran nuke deal, which inhibited them from getting nuclear weapons. But let's just take him, he made a little mistake. Mm-hmm. He's getting older. I go through this myself, and I'm not quite as old as Chuck Schumer. But in the second construction, we don't want a forever war. But that's a limiting principle on how much we don't want a forever war. But we don't want Iran to have nukes. So in other words, we don't want a forever war. However, it's okay to have one if it prevents Iran from having nukes.
Well, I mean, at least it's not just an argument right now on the basis of procedure, whether or not Trump has come to Congress to ask for authorization for this war. It has slightly more political salience when he's speaking about, what, another endless war, another forever war? That seems to be the line. But then when you look into how many exit ramps there are for Chuck Schumer and his Zionist ideology and his deep desire to collaborate with the fascist administration, you can see where the issue is there. Okay, no endless war. So do you support what Trump's proposed timeline is that he said to the New York Times of 4 to 5 weeks as we arm the Kurds and say, here's your time to seize the government and we're going to make it really clear that the CIA is funding you? Will that go over well domestically in Iran that hates U.S. intervention and our support for the brutal Shah and all of that cultural memory there? And then the first part is even more egregious, conceding that this action was backing the idea that this action, this war crime, was about preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Iran has not been in, like, seriously developing a nuclear weapon for decades. That's what U.S. intelligence says. That's what U.S. intelligence has said since the beginning of the 2000s. But the Zionist lobby wants this as a pretext to destabilize Iran because it's the greatest threat to Israel in the region. And the Greater Israel Project means that we have to take over more and more land, including in Lebanon, and Iran supports Hezbollah, and they fight back against us in Lebanon. So, I mean, it's really disgusting. And the Politico has this article where they're talking about this supplemental funding for Iran. And it seems like there's this emergency funding package that's coming up. Chuck Schumer's quote is, "Before you can feel satisfied about a supplemental, and I haven't seen it, you have to know what the real goals are and what the end game is." Chris Coons, a Democratic senator from Delaware, Biden's, I would say, protege, Says he expects the Pentagon will send Congress a supplemental funding request and vowed to, quote, make sure we are making all the investments we can to keep U.S. troops safe. So when you look, read between the lines there, what does that mean? They are trying to prime the public and their base to say we're going to support the supplemental funding package for Trump's illegal criminal war in Iran. Fascist collaborator, resign.
Let's go to the idea of that Chuck Schumer is so concerned about a nuclear-armed Iran. Now, we have had report after report after report after report after report. I mean, I'm being literal now, from the CIA, that Iran is not near and in many instances not pursuing the building of a nuclear weapon. And we've had counter report from Israelis, counter report from people who want to go to war. We heard from the foreign minister of Oman that the Iranians had agreed to no stockpile of uranium-enriched material, which meant that it was impossible for them to build a bomb under those auspices. And the next thing we heard from the White House and the Israelis is we need to bomb them then in that instance. Here is a report from David Rode on MS Now. Witkoff apparently was on Hannity last night saying that the Iranians had enough enriched uranium material to build 11 nuclear bombs. And it turns out, this is going to be shocking, that was a lie.
I had the same questions about no real explanation about why this had to happen now. He brought up something that we've actually done some reporting on. It's basically claims that Iran was actively pursuing a nuclear weapon, and this is something Steve Witkoff talked about in a Fox News interview a couple nights ago. And we contacted people with knowledge in the negotiations. Witkoff claimed that the Iranians bragged that they had enough enriched uranium for 11 nuclear bombs. It was a Sean Hannity interview. People who were present during the negotiations said that never happened, that the Iranians never made that statement. And in fact, they said we have enriched uranium because we started enriching uranium again after President Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal President Obama negotiated. So it's a continuation of the administration struggling to explain why they had to do this now. And in terms of the objectives, I was struck like you. It's just they're in use. We talked about exquisite, standoff mm-hmm. munitions. At one point, he compared it to a football game. And at the end, he was sort of talking about, pushing the throttle up. Waging war is one of the most serious things the American government can do. Six Americans have lost their lives already. And so mm-hmm. He seems enamored with the ability of air power alone and these bombs to break the will of Iranian forces. And maybe they will. And this is a terrible regime and maybe they will be toppled. But I'm still concerned about the strategy the administration has here. And I still think that the objective is unclear.
We're going to have a guest tomorrow, Professor Robert Pape, on, who's going to talk about how it's a complete lie when you look at the historical examinations of using air power to try to topple regimes, that there's a 100% fail rate.
Never happened.
You need ground troops. It necessitates ground troops. And that is what we're hearing in terms of what some of the options are that we're hearing coming out of that classified briefing that the Democratic senators spoke about yesterday.
And I also want to be clear, because if we're moving into this posture again, being at war, six American servicemen have died. When I listened to my morning AP feed, there was an extended story about one of them. It's heartbreaking. A father talking about talking to his son on Saturday, and then he's gone, and they can't believe it. And the sister is, it's horrible. There's been at least 1,000 Iranians killed, and we know that at least 100 plus were children. And even when this guy talks about why this is not a good idea, We're bombing Iranian forces to topple the regime. No, we're not.
Nope.
We're bombing Iranians. Some are Iranian forces, but others are, and some are, but others are infrastructure to make Iranians suffer, or it's just we're bombing Iranians, just civilians, to make them suffer. People who, according to the own premise of this conflict, have less of a say over their government than we do. And so, you know, as we move forward in this, and I went through this with Iraq, you know, it is inevitable. We're going to have U.S. service men and women killed, and it's horrible. They don't deserve to die. Neither do Iranian civilians deserve to die. And frankly, you know, I don't know if Iranian soldier, I mean, we can't go into each individual person, but it is, just be conscious as we get the news reports of how, and we saw this obviously with Israel and Palestine, but it's going to be sort of a little bit a closer to home, where the loss of a U.S. service person is going to be considered a horrible, horrible tragedy. The deaths of 100 children in a school in Iran is going to be, you know, a mistake.
If it's mentioned at all. I'm not even hearing it at all.
It was mentioned to Hegseth yesterday, and he said they're investigating.
I'm sure they're looking
into it.
It's
a mistake that we're investigating.
Clay Travis said it might have been the Iranians themselves.
But
the
point being,
that before?
The point being is that, you know, human beings are human beings.
Yeah.
And it is one thing to be able to justify this, at least in your own mind, when this is a kill or be killed situation. If we don't fight back against them, but no one has been able to even make a remote, like the remotest argument that Iran was a threat to anyone they know.
Our intelligence services have undercut that claim.
Yes. Yes.
We should just keep that in mind. Yeah.
I mean, the one funny clip on this is the Mark Wayne Mullen one.
Oh yeah, let's go to Mark Wayne Mullen. I mean, let's just go through the people who are defending this action. Some of them can't even explain what it is. Mark Wayne Mullen is the guy who got the short straw, I think, in the Senate, and they're like, "You got to do this, dude," and he's like, "Really? Okay." So wait, can somebody just give me some talking points? No.
Get out there.
Get out there. You can do this.
Try not to say anything.
You'll concede this is war. You'll concede this is war.
We haven't declared war. They declared war on us, but we haven't.
War. Secretary Hegseth.
We haven't declared
war. Just now, you said this is war.
They've called it war.
They called it war. What I was saying, okay, well, that was a misspoke. What I was saying that they've declared war on us, but war is ugly. It always has been ugly. But we're taking out a regime that's been trying to attack us for quite some time.
But you're not.
So he doesn't want to say it's a war.
Apparently, when he came up, there's a longer clip.
Yeah, there's a longer one where he walks out and he goes, "Look, this is war."
Yes.
And then they go, I'll find that.
Yeah, this is war. And they say, so you concede this is war. No.
No. That was a misspoke.
They're doing war. We're not doing war.
They're doing war by being bombed by us.
Exactly. The classic, they say it's war, but only because we bombed them.
And killed their leader and are bombing the capital of their country and the biggest city in the country.
They didn't bomb us, so we're not at war. You understand the way that works, right?
Yeah.
You're only at war if you're getting bombed.
Right.
And never mind those soldiers dying.
I do love this new...
was friendly fire, so that could have happened anywhere. That could have happened over North Carolina.
Well,
if we had, you know...
The friendly fire
foreign
one.
Fighter shooting.
Yeah. The friendly fire one. Those people survived, I believe. But no, it was the bombs in Kuwait, I guess, the six that were killed.
Yeah. But that wasn't in America. So
right. And I just, the new rules of engagement in the Trump 2.0 world is, if Washington, D.C. were to be repeatedly bombed, and a school of over 100 girls were to be bombed by the Iranians, and Trump and Melania were to be killed by the Iranians, plus a bunch of other cabinet officials. It's not a war.
Well, it would be for us if we struck back.
That's true. We would, if we start, then
but nobody's waging war on us.
Exactly. Our response would be us being just absolutely bloodthirsty, horrible people, and responding in that way would be warmongering.
This is complicated. Yeah. So let's go to someone who we can appreciate a little more. The one Democrat who seems to be in favor of this, at least vocally, and he will explain this to you. Mm. Here is what's that? Couldn't find a law. Okay, here is Fetterman. We only have a brief clip of this. He is speaking after the intelligence briefing on the U.S. Attacks. Go back just a little bit there. Oh, Matt's got it at 43 times speed.
You know, we can't even maintain our core responsibilities to keep our government open, you know, itself right now.
Sarah, would you change your position on war powers in terms of a ground invasion into Iran?
What? No, I'm saying it's like this is.
The U.S. have done more to protect Americans who are now stranded abroad. Israel received a warning on Friday before this attack for an authorized departure there, but there are many Americans from other countries now about.
Anything else?
Senator, Americans have been concerned about with regard to retaliation here domestically. Any cells that we need to worry about? Anything?
I don't have any specific kinds of intelligence on that, of course. But, you know, our DHS system is shut down, so that's probably not great timing for that. And again, I'm the only Democrat that votes that's wrong to do that. Yeah, we all want to make some changes on ICE, but we all know that won't have any impact what they've done, and now it's shut down.
Okay. I feel like we're in good hands.
This is irrelevant, but how much help do you think it is to bend your ear when you're trying to hear?
Listen, I get when you can't hear things, but one of the ways that I respond when I can't hear things is I'll do this because my hearing's not great, particularly after like 25 years of headsets. One of the things I'll do is, what's that? Could you say that again? I couldn't hear you. I know you asked me a question.
That's like what a 100-year-old man does.
The first question, incidentally,
I just can't
The first question was, will you revisit your perspective on the War Powers Act if we put boots on the ground? I can't stand that phrase, boots on the ground, because it's actually human beings in the boots. I have no problem. We want to drop boots on Iran. I'm open to that. It would be good for the boot industry in this country. And it would be maybe helpful for people if we just did it in the right way. But it's humans on the ground shooting at other humans and killing other humans. And he was asked, would you reconsider or revisit your perspective on the War Powers Act? And I think his answer was,
and then turn away.
Why are you bothering me with this? Can I go to bed, please? God, it's like you see how it's a struggle for him just to even be standing there. Why not resign?
Honestly.
What's the point?
Yeah. It's undignified.
Apparently, though, his dad is a big Republican, and he's in this like completely almost like childlike mental state, and his dad is giving him all the praise. And so it's good to know
you're doing good, buddy.
It's good to know that we have a senator whose mental and emotional capacity is so diminished that he's basically becoming a Republican because he's trying to make his daddy proud.
There was the thing with Nixon's someone's vice president candidate in the Democratic Party. I forget what election it was, but it turned out that he was getting therapy and that was
Eagleton.
And there was a huge scandal. He had to drop out of the race. Fetterman's whole thing has set that back about to exactly the 1970s with his sort of acting like he's a good example for it. And then coming out and being this sort of atrocious, like it's done harm, I think.
Well, yes, I would imagine. But I mean, to be fair, I would like to. It's obviously not possible to traverse time in this way, but it would be fun to see like a mental competition between him and Dianne Feinstein.
I was thinking Mitch McConnell. Now
Mitch McConnell just has large periods of time where he doesn't speak, but
This would be a great TV show.
Yeah.
It's like, are you smarter than a senator?
But maybe Joe Biden can sub in for...
Yeah, he moderates it.
For Feinstein. AI Dianne Feinstein at 92. We only use the data from the hearings on the Supreme Court picks.
Right.
And then current John Fetterman moderated by Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Boom. And that's what I want instead of the UFC fights on the lawn for 250. That's the real display of American competition. Yes. I want
250.
Yes. Yes. That's my suggestion. And maybe the Republicans can get on board because it's all Democrats. That's my blood sport.
I want to talk about the primaries, but before we do, I think this is important because, you know, we will give grief to politicians when they support things that we don't like, mm-hmm. right? But we never, ever, well, not ever, ever, but I think we should also acknowledge when they do say things that we do like. Mm-hmm. And it is a rare opportunity that you get to have those two different dynamics with the same person within like just a matter of weeks of each other. And so congratulations to Gavin Newsom. There's a saying, and I'm sure Brian knows this, in New England, if you don't like the weather, then just wait. And that's the same thing with Gavin Newsom.
They say that everywhere.
I know they do say that. I found that out like the other day. But you'll recall when Gavin Newsom implied, was it with like with
Van Lathan?
Yeah.
Van Lathan asked them a question, not a particular about was it about AIPAC?
It was about if you were going to take AIPAC money, and we should give credit to friend of the show Jasper Nathaniel, who quote tweeted this clip and literally was referencing that. He said, "It's interesting that Newsom is suddenly changing his tune on Israel."
That's Medicare.
But
maybe Jasper did the same.
Well, I'm reading from Jasper's tweet. Yeah.
Everybody was doing that.
I just find it interesting because this quote, that's the clip that happened with Van, was when Van was asking him about AIPAC support. His response just a few months ago was, "It's interesting you'd ask me that," implying that Van was anti-Semitic for asking that question.
It's
so fixated Van Lathan on AIPAC.
So fixated on the whole Israel thing. What a weird thing to do.
I just think it's weird.
And you'll recall, like, when he was on with Shapiro, Gavin Newsom was also sort of like, "I'm not into this whole Israel bashing thing." Well, folks, seasons change, and Gavin Newsom does too.
And he got some poll numbers back.
Here we go.
And a lot of Democrats have looked at the Netanyahu regime and felt like, you know what, we don't like the trajectory he's on. It's time to rethink the U.S. relationship with Israel, especially military support.
Well,
where do you stand?
Making that easy right now. Let's talk about that. But the issue of Bibi's interesting because he's got his own domestic issues. He's trying to stay out of jail. He's got an election coming up. He's potentially on the ropes. He's got folks, the hard line, that want to annex the West Bank. I mean, Freeman and others are talking about it appropriately, sort of an apartheid state. They couldn't even, I mean, we're talking about regime change. For 2 years, they haven't even been able to solve the Hamas question in Israel. So this is, I mean, you know, I want to be careful here, but, you know, in so many ways, that influence in the context of the conversation of where Trump ultimately landed on this is pretty damn self-evident. And so Rubio may have been saying something else in the context of what he ultimately said, in terms of being sort of pulled into some of these things. But I will say this, didn't surprise me in this context. I don't know if it was Napoleon or whoever said about a sword, the only thing you can't use a sword for is sitting on it. And when you bring two aircraft carriers out there and you assemble the kind of military force that Trump did over the last few weeks, it didn't surprise me ultimately they moved that direction.
Okay. All right. So I just, 1 second, just a quick pause to take it point by point. So this is going to be the line from Democrats who don't actually want to fundamentally change our relationship with the genocidal colonial state of Israel. They are going to say it's Netanyahu and put it all on him. We played this clip last week. The leader of the opposition to Netanyahu, which includes kind of liberal slash centrist groups within the context of Israeli society, endorsed after Mike Huckabee came out on with Tucker Carlson and said, we want to support the greater Israel theory, which is the expansion of the Israeli state into conquering land in Lebanon, in Syria, in other countries around the Middle East. He said that he was basically all for that. So on the fundamental issues of Israeli society and the expansion of the state and the seizure of land, there is absolutely zero meaningful political opposition within Israel that's going to oppose that. So everybody that hears Netanyahu come out of the mouths and there not being any sort of systemic critique about Israel from Democratic politicians should know that that is a signal that they are not going to be good on this issue. That's just the case.
But Emma,
yes,
can you make an assessment of the politics of a country just because over the past 30 years, more than half of that Netanyahu's been prime minister? Can you really just say, they have put a literal terrorist in charge of the West Bank and the finances of the entire government? He's in charge of that. Can you really just say that it's not like the government there? Like what other functions does a government have besides spending money?
Right. Right. That's just the fundamental, point there.
Well, we got more. He might turn it around in the second half.
All right.
Do you think looking down the road that the United States should consider maybe, you know, rethinking our military support for Israel?
It breaks my heart because the current leadership in Israel is walking us down that path where I don't think you have a choice but that consideration. I mean, to say this is in America's interest at a time when affordability is at crisis levels, where you had an administration who literally got elected saying this is exactly opposite of what they would ever consider doing. The fact that we are in this now regional war, all these proxies, the fact that we, you know, and all the grift and the corruption, that's also marks a huge part of this. And that's a real conversation we need to have, this board of peace and the peace that the Witkoff family's getting and the peace that Kushner is getting and the peace that Trump Jr. is getting.
That's the same joke that Elon did, too. That was also taken from somebody else, wasn't
it? Mel Brooks.
Also, we're not going to allow you guys to pivot into just throwing chum to the audience about hating Trump and his cronies. The issue right now is genocide. The issue is a fundamental reorientation of our relationship with this failed colonial state in the Middle East that is like that is dragging us into of course, the Trump administration is complicit in this, as was Biden, but into horrific, horrific conflicts that have knock-on effects for Americans, which I know they're supposed to care about.
Well, it's funny also, him going on the affordability crisis. Like, I'll be honest. Like, we just hacked rich people. We can afford stuff in this country.
Like, wait a second.
Our obligations to this part of the world and our foreign policy have nothing to do with the fact that we can't pay rent. We should not be supporting Israel, even if I could afford, if we could all afford to go to a new apartment right now.
The other point about this clip too is that the idea that Gavin Newsom can go through a primary without having to deal with his twists and turns, like he is going to fight to stop this billionaire tax in California, and then watch him. If the wealth tax that Bernie Sanders is going to introduce and start to talk up, if that gains any type of traction, watch him months from now go like, well, actually, I can see, you know, it's interesting. I'm heartbroken by this, but I'm starting to realize like maybe there's too much wealth concentration and we need to figure out some mechanism to deal with this. And but I don't know, you know, taxing seems like a blunt instrument.
This is
we should do
his record. If once people get past the fact that they're tickled by the fact that he has somebody who runs his social media who is online enough to understand memes, perhaps we can get into the substance of what Gavin Newsom actually represents, which is somebody who is fighting right now, as Sam says, to combat this billionaire tax, somebody who was more comfortable with Charlie Kirk and Steve Bannon and throwing and Ben Shapiro and throwing trans people under the bus than standing up for them, as he likes to look at his past support for gay marriage. Once it had it was a majorly popular position in the state of California as an example of his political bravery, but throws trans kids under the bus. That's easy for him. Just at the end of 2024, he vetoed or killed a bill that would have required hedge funds and private equity to have more rules and regulations on jacking up prices for prescription drugs. This cannot be somebody who represents the Democratic Party, billionaire, a coward who goes where the political winds tell him to go.
Free advice, and you know, I will not vote for him. But if he wants to make, if I was his advisor, you can't saying this stuff with PodSave is one thing. Go on, you want to do Ben Shapiro show, you want to do Dave Rubin, whoever. You say this to them, and then you see what happens, and dig in there, and then we'll be interested. But this sort of thing of belatedly acknowledging what the people—I mean, he just basically chameleons whoever's show.
Totally.
Yeah, and this as a contrast, like James Tallarico's politics are not where we've talked about this. Is not
not great on Israel.
Not all of our politics. Not great on Israel.
It's also not running in the bluest state in the country.
But it's a contrast as to say, like, you know, Tallarico, he supports the PRO Act. Our friend David Griscom has a really good piece in Jacobin speaking about this, and how also he identifies a villain, the billionaires. Tallarico will unequivocally talk about how the billionaires are the problem and that we need to be standing up to them with his message in Texas. You can still be sort of moderate as on issues like that, and identify the villains in a way that, like, actually builds political power and builds a constituency that can be lasting. What I also like about Tallarico and how he was able to win yesterday is the constituency that he cultivated being a salient way to defeat Trumpism in 2026. He just was absolutely dominant in this primary with Latino voters, particularly in the south and western parts of the state. He ran up the numbers with Latino voters around Houston. The Latino voters are key here to because Trump made such historic gains with them in 2024. He also was pretty dominant in the white suburbs. But like this is his appeal to those groups is like a path to victory potentially in Texas. But it's not just the groups that he appeals to. Really, the fact that he identifies billionaires as the villain and he speaks about like Christianity in this humane manner, I think is like a potent antidote to the sadism of Trump in this era. So we'll see. But I was encouraged that he won fairly decisively in Texas last night.
Are we going to play the...
Oh, and here's a clip of him and his victory speech.
We are not just trying to win an election. We are trying to fundamentally change our politics. And it's working. The number of young people who showed up to vote in this election is unprecedented. The number of Texans who have never voted before but showed up in this election is unprecedented. The number of independents and Republicans who voted in this Democratic primary is unprecedented. This is proof that there is something happening in Texas. Tonight, the people of our state gave this country a little bit of hope. And a little bit of hope is a dangerous thing. I want to thank y'all. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being in this fight. God bless y'all. Thank you.
So, and I think all of Crockett's comments about saying Latinos have a slave mentality also were circulated a lot and had an impact on this race. But, I mean, you know, she has strengths, too, and we'll see where her career takes her at this point.
Where is it going to take her?
I'm more encouraged that the candidate that's replacing her is more progressive and is actually a Justice Democrat. But I am just happy that her style of really individualized, factionalized politics that puts forward like this kind of clapback I don't know, rot within the Democratic Party that's less focused on like collectivism and more on individual achievements and literally, I mean, there's like a good amount of narcissism in how she campaigned. That was Delta's decisive blow, because that has had success in factionalizing Democratic voters and diluting the power of, say, like the kind of insurgent populist parts of the party.
It was shameful of Allred and Crockett jumped in with both feet on it, of the smearing of Tallarico down the stretch, which was to paint him as like anti-black. I think was disgusting and typical of the of certain parts of the Democratic Party. And it is very good that it lost. And hopefully we can turn the page on that sort of cynical type of
campaign. That's the thing. It was just so cynical.
And people saw through it. And there's maybe some people that don't yet, but everyone else is moving on.
Meanwhile, here is the guy, Frederick Haynes, who is going to be, it's a blue district in Texas, all but assured to be the next congressperson from Texas, what number is it?
I'm not sure, but it's around Dallas.
Nine?
And this clip is from October 8th, 2023.
Because I recognize that we've got to be pro-Israel. Yeah, we got to do that. Or we get in trouble. Well, I'm coming to get in trouble. Israel, and I'm going to quote Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter says that Israel is engaging in apartheid with Palestinians. And so the Palestinians who don't have the weaponry of Israel, the Palestinians don't have the financial backing from the United States that Israel has. And so they throw their rocks and shoot their arrows, and Israel is able to bomb them and kill them. Watch in the news a disparity between Palestinians being killed and Israelis being killed. It is totally unfair, but this country's gonna stand on the side of apartheid because that's its track record. It stood by apartheid in South Africa because it created apartheid in this country.
I would say it's a bit of an upgrade from Jasmine Crockett.
It's so odd to hear a Christian rhythm say something I believe in. It's unsettling in some ways.
And to draw back to the Jim Crow apartheid regime in America, I think is extremely important.
Yep. Provides some context for all of this and understanding that this is not something that's just cropped up.
Yeah.
So that's good.
That's good.
Pretty good.
I mean, there's going to be this is going to be the most successful year ever for Justice Democrats. And we don't really have the concept of the squad anymore. Right. I mean, but what we are going to have is maybe a platoon.
It's a larger, more diffuse, for better and worse.
Right. Because is Delia Ramirez considered a part of the squad? She's one of the best members of Congress that we have. It's not exactly clear.
Half of the people we think of as a squad aren't even in Congress anymore.
Right. Well, that's true. But still, and Cori Bush running again.
St. Louis, tap into Cori Bush. We need to take out Wesley Bell, which I think should be doable.
This is the year.
The Nita Olam race is a big bummer. Just to give people a little more context on that one, Valerie Fouché looks like she's probably going to win that primary by less than a point or around 1 point. Bernie endorsed Nita Olam. Notably, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did not. And I think that was probably one of the major factors in this race, because Fouché is actually technically a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And
oh my God.
For AOC's purposes, I get the Congressional Progressive Caucus trying to have some discipline around endorsements and stuff like that. It's not my favorite thing, but the overall point that we've tried to make on this show many times is that perhaps the CPC should have stricter standards and be a smaller block rather than have people like Fouché included, because she'd sprinted to the left a little bit. And even her rejection of AIPAC money, but then secretly taking it via Hakeem Jeffries, was a recognition of that. But I mean, perhaps people in the Congressional Progressive Caucus shouldn't be, you know, should only be taking small dollar contributions or something.
Chantel
like that.
Brown, who's in Congress over Nina Turner, in part because of a record spending by the Israel lobby, has taken more from the Israel lobby than every other member of Congress from Ohio combined, including Republicans. But she's in the Progressive Caucus.
Somebody on the IM is saying that they sent an email regarding Neda Alam. I don't know if we can find that because we're not taking a... I can't find it at the moment. But the IM was saying... Let me get back to that if I can. No, won't be able to. I sent you an email this morning providing a little local insight into why Neda Alam lost. I encourage you to check it. You found it out? Oh, wait, there it is. Yeah, I think I got it too. Todd from Raleigh here. I wanted to pass on a little insight from the ground on why Neda lost, likely lost her race. I live in NC4 and I wanted her to win very badly. And I'm grateful you had her on the show. However, it's worth saying that she did not have a good campaign strategy at all. It's just somebody's opinion, but they're in Raleigh and they're obviously a fan of hers. Her team did not deploy canvassers effectively across areas she needed to do damage control in, namely Chapel Hill and Chatham County. The Fauci name is a local political legacy family, and people are primed to vote for Fauci by default in Chapel Hill. And she did not make a sufficient effort to make inroads with them in Chapel Hill or find new voters in Carrboro. When you lose by one percentage point, there's probably a wide array of things that could have been done better to have you win. Her team did not properly equip volunteers with training. Most volunteers only got literature in a minivan code, no training. A minivan code is you fill into the app. The app that gives you information as to where who you're talking to. I can't help but think that that has to do with her burning local bridges. Neda has a history of siding with the party over grassroots organizers, and she endorsed against a DSA slate for Dunham City Council. She voted against Durham County holding a county pride parade, but then hosted a private pride event that was a fundraiser for her and falsely accused the DSA-aligned Durham City Councilwoman of assault. She also never applied for a DSA endorsement and only started her campaign less than 3 months ago, but did show up to an electoral DSA event and took a picture with our local electors.
Okay. Well, no, I mean, these are all notable. Perhaps DSA could have been more helpful for her in that regard. I also just think, like, you know, we can also take away from this campaign something more broad, which is that with all of those pitfalls that you're speaking about, she came within one percentage points, also with a massive fundraising disadvantage against an incumbent. And it was basically because the incumbent had past associations with AIPAC.
So it's about Neda and more about what the people wanted, which was almost to put her over the top, despite all of that, over a known name.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, build those relationships from the ground up.
Yep.
Don't skip over because... be a thousand votes make a difference.
Yeah.
I remember I lost by 14 for student government.
Class president?
A class president I never lost. Student government. But I was running as a sophomore, which is pretty rare. So. John Benjamin didn't vote.
I didn't know we were in the presence of such political royalty.
He was on the couch.
Were you running against a legacy family?
No, he was a J board guy. I mean, I liked him and we were friends, but I don't want to get into it. I'm not hanging on to that. Like I did my SAT score.
How long
ago
was that?
Like my SAT score. I'm a regular guy. I lost my first campaign. Well, actually it was my second. I mean, I won my first.
Regular guy. I'm an idiot. I got a 12 on the SAT.
What are you talking about?
I lost my government job. I'm an idiot.
All right, let's read five IMs, and then we're going to get out of here. WTF Cody. James was the first politician I've donated to since I fell out of the coconut tree. I don't know what the since is, but
Shout out Kamala Harris for getting in there with the late endorsement of Jasmine Crockett.
You know, she just keeps showing how great her instincts are. Bonk.
Maybe she's got like a humiliation thing.
That is really impressive, though, right? Like, people don't listen. Those are they think about this stuff. Like, her team sat down and was like, "We got to do this."
I took it as a very bad sign.
Crockett's like, "No."
The point is that it probably had absolutely no impact except to reflect poorly on Kamala Harris.
Right, right. Like, even from a self-preservation standpoint, lady, you're saying you want to run for president in 2028. I mean, I don't like making predictions, and I wanted Tallarico to win, but, like, I would not have done, like, a robocall. What she was doing, calling within the final 2 weeks? Like
was it in the last 2 weeks?
It was
like
recent.
It was, like, shorter than that.
It was late.
Later than 2 weeks. That's the thing, is I think, like, if you're going to jump in and do something, you know, and it's not like maybe there was, you know, maybe the only thing that we can't see is that there could have been like internal dynamics. There were friends on either campaign or there was a relationship there that like somebody was like, please, we need you to do this. And she did it as a favor. Honestly,
I mean, that
that's the most likely explanation.
Of course.
Otherwise, like what? Like,
yeah,
there wasn't like.
Well,
you didn't read
drive
stories
turnout.
In Politico like, we don't know why Kamala Harris hasn't endorsed anybody in this race. Nobody was asking that question.
The Dallas Dems are pretty powerful, and I think like that's where a lot of the Crockett support came from.
Yes.
And to me, it was always, is the party going to be more powerful, or is it going to be this grassroots energy that looks like Tallarico has? And Tallarico's grassroots energy won out.
Well, that's the sort of the theme for this entire cycle, isn't it? Like, The party is not carrying the day in the vast majority of these really contested primaries.
Right. I mean, we didn't even touch on the Al Green piece. That was another Justice Democrat, right, who took that district. Al Green has been a good progressive, but that was more like he's just older. And
yeah, who was it?
They were crammed into one district due to redistricting. The guy's last name starts with a C. I'm blanking on it.
Looks like there's a runoff, maybe.
Christian. Yeah, there's going to be a runoff. But maybe I'm wrong that he was a Justice Democrat.
Bob Brooks for Congress has now been endorsed by the Working Families Party as well. He's in a crowded primary in the only Medicare for All Bernie-endorsed candidate in Pennsylvania 7th.
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't think he is a Justice Democrat. My bad.
Tack thumb.
Oh, the ponytail, though.
No, Green's good. Yeah.
Tack thumb. I know there's a lot going on, but with Kansas's attack on transgender people, that is sure to be followed by more states. I would love you guys to have someone like Aaron Reed on.
Yes, I know. We need to talk more about that story.
The good news is in New York, Tish James has forced, I can't remember what hospital, I think it was Mount Sinai, had cut back on its trans care for people under the age of 18, for minors under the age of 18, and because they were threatened by the federal government. And Tish James says, you cannot do that. Ad hominy. Since when is attacking someone first defense?
A hegemon.
Orwellian America.
Toilette. How many seconds did it take this war to exceed the amount of the supposed Minnesota fraud scandal? 10, 20 seconds? Just the planes we've lost to friendly fire, at least alone, is at least $300 million.
Getting the ships over there.
Yeah, the images out of Tehran right now are apocalyptic, just so people are aware. Over the past few hours, Israel and the U.S. have been bombing the hell out of a major city in Iran.
Dan from Columbus, I love when politicians explain the question instead of answering it. That's a conversation we need to have. Yes, that's why I'm asking your opinion, you greasy hair.
That's my favorite thing.
My favorite
we need a real conversation about that.
I'm going to have to take a big look at that.
Yeah.
That's the one I like.
What's a big look when you widen your eyes?
Niles, I got laid off last year as an indirect result of the Trump administration halting wind farm development. I've since found employment with a local engineering firm, but just got a call from an ex-colleague whose current firm is looking for skilled geologists to work on the pre-investment phase of the Big Bend section of the border wall. I've taken money from clients I have ethical problems with, but this is something entirely more evil. Really torn, but someone is going to take that money, indeed.
Wait, they're naming sections of the wall?
Naming?
Big Bend section?
I have a feeling that's probably a geographic, the river.
Okay.
But it may be like a place. I don't think they're saying like...
Call it the Big Bend.
I thought they were doing Franklin. Yeah. Like, this is the Franklin section of the wall.
All right, two more.
The Elvis Presley wall.
Pope PAX. Categorize and standardize internet algorithms to create handles for regulating them, especially in regards to transparency and safety. Indeed, I think there's ways of doing this. But I know the libertarians in the office disagree.
Damn it.
Tim Pool's beanie.
See, this is why you guys don't get invited places.
Schumer has got everything he wanted from Trump, war with Iran, and ICE deporting Palestinian protesters, indeed.
And he can sit back and passively benefit from it. Or he thinks he can.
Aaron is not cool. Enough with this tort maxing. Sam's retirement is just him in a room with unplugged microphone arguing with AI video chatbot. That's probably not too far off. And the final I am of the day. Serena. Sam is Charlie Day in a Sam suit. Matt, Brian, Emma.
By the way, I'm going to be on the Vanguard in about an hour.
Oh, nice.
Matt, Brian, Emma. Catch Matt on the Vanguard in an hour. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made. The option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick. We'll be right back.
big look when you widen your eyes.
Niles, I got laid off last year as an indirect result of the Trump administration halting wind farm development. I've since found employment with a local engineering firm, but just got a call from an ex-colleague whose current firm is looking for skilled geologists to work on the pre-investment phase of the Big Bend section of the border wall. I've taken money from clients I have ethical problems with, but this is something entirely more evil. Really torn, but someone is going to take that money, indeed.
Wait, they're naming sections of the wall?
Naming?
Big Bend section?
I have a feeling that's probably a geographic, the river. Okay. But it may be a place. I don't think they're saying
the big.
I thought they were doing Ben Franklin. This is the Ben Franklin section of the wall.
All right, two more.
The Elvis Presley wall.
Pope PAX. Categorize and standardize internet algorithms to create handles for regulating them, especially in regards to transparency and safety. Indeed, I think there's ways of doing this. But I know the libertarians in the office disagree.
Damn it.
Tim Pool's Beatty.
See, this is why you guys don't get invited places.
Schumer has gotten everything he wanted from Trump, war with Iran, and ICE deporting Palestinian protesters, indeed.
And he can sit back and passively benefit from it. Or he thinks he can.
Aaron is not cool. Enough with this tort maxing. Sam's retirement is just him in a room with unplugged microphone arguing with AI video chatbot. That's probably not too far off. And the final I am of the day. Serena. Sam is Charlie Day in a Sam suit. Matt, Brian, Emma.
By the way, I'm going to be on the Vanguard in about an hour.
Oh, ooh. Nice.
Matt, Brian, Emma. Catch Matt on the Vanguard in an hour. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess I'm where I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The nun shifted into you while I shifted in and out of.